Welcome to the Navigating Hollywood podcast. My name is Alan Wolf, and I'm a filmmaker and an author. Navigating Hollywood encourages and equips entertainment professionals to live relationally and spiritually holistic lives. If you work in entertainment, visit navigatinghollywood.org to discover how you can get involved. Today, we're joined by host, actor, and writer Tori Belleci. Tori was featured as the Daredevil on the most successful and longest-running pop science show in TV history, Mythbusters, where everyone got to see he can build just about anything. He also starred with Top Gear's Richard Hammond in The Great Escapists, the hit shows Pumpkin Chunkin' and The Explosion Show, The White Rabbit Project on Netflix, and Thrill Factor on the Travel Channel. He's also appeared on Iron Chef in Hell's Kitchen as a celebrity judge, but perhaps his greatest achievement is being one of my longtime friends. Welcome, Tori.
Oh, thank you. That is so nice.
It's super fun that our birthdays are one day apart.
I remember I moved to LA to work on Scooby-Doo, and your 30th birthday was the day before mine. And so you had a big party at someone's house and we were all hanging out. And I remember leaving the party and you went, Tori. And you like, I was like across the street, like getting into my car. And I was like, what? And you're like, just remember, this is the last night you're in your 20s. And it was like, ugh. It was like a little stab in the back of my neck. It was like, ugh. But it's nice though, because, you know, every year now I get to call you up the day before and go, hey, old man, happy birthday.
No, and I can give you a preview of older age, just for 24 hours. I just have a 24-hour head start. Oh my gosh, that is such a funny memory. I mentioned you can build just about anything. Are you constantly building things around your house?
Oh my gosh, every day.
Really?
You know, it's funny, people ask me, you know, because, you know, I was a model maker up at ILM for years, and people ask me, like, when you're not working, do you build models? Like, do you get model cars and model planes and make models? I'm like, no, that's my job. When I'm off, I'm off. But as far as building, yes, I have been doing a lot of building. I have this warehouse that during the pandemic, I converted into an apartment. So that way, you know, ripping out floors, putting in cabinets, building bathrooms. So yes, I have been doing a lot of building.
Now, when you were a kid, your dad taught you how to make a Molotov cocktail.
I've always been a curious kid, but then to have a father who was basically a big kid just continued that kind of erratic behavior, not great behavior. For 4th of July, we used to take legal fireworks because here in California, everything's illegal. But we would take legal fireworks and make them illegal. It just kept progressing. And at one point, we started making pipe bombs. We were lighting them off in our backyard, which is stupid, right? Because the neighbors would hear these noises. But then we built this one and it blew up. And our neighbor came over and he was listening to the police scanner. And he goes, the police are on their way. Oh. But in hindsight, I think he called the police. So we left. We got out of the house. We took off. End of the day, we were like, all right, let's go back. I'm sure the cops are gone by now. And we were pulling up the street. We turned the corner and I said, wouldn't it be funny if there was like cops in front of the house? Sure enough, there were two cop cars parked in our driveway and there was cops going through my backyard. So I like turned around, took off, stayed out for the rest of the night. There was one point where I was driving my car down this road and I see a cop car like going in the opposite direction. His lights went on and he took off and made a turn. And I like got, you know, I jumped on the freeway and I got out of there. Turns out there was an APB on my truck. So they think I'm like this terrorist. I just want to get into special effects in the movies.
Oh, wow.
So the next day, my parents get back from their camping trip. And, you know, I come in the front door and I'm like, look, you know, the cops, I let off some pipe bombs. Like the police are after me. And they're all, yeah, the neighbors already told us what happened. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm a fugitive. So the chief of police comes to the front door and he's got all these pieces of metal from the pipe that had gone over our house into the neighbor's yards. The woman said that, you know, shrapnel just started raining down in their driveway. So I was like, oh my gosh, like that's, I'm so sorry. This is, you know, never happen again. And he looked at me and he goes, you're of age, you're 18. And I go, yeah. He's all, this is a felony. I should take you into jail. Like, I should arrest you right now. But I talked to your teachers, I talked to your neighbors. They all told me you're a good kid and that you want to get into Hollywood in special effects. This is not the way they do it in Hollywood. This ever happens again, I'm not going to hesitate. I'm going to arrest you. So I was like, fair enough. Like 12, 13 years later, I'm on Mythbusters and I go home and now this chief of police sees me and he's like, look at you now. You're getting paid to blow stuff up. I feel like it was like the hand of God. He said, if we arrest this kid now, his life's going
to
be ruined.
Yeah. Just to think that path, how it could have gone a very different direction.
It was a pivotal moment in my life.
Now, I remember when you first got the offer to join Mythbusters and you weren't sure you wanted to take it. Have you ever thought about how that one decision completely altered your life?
You know, I was a model maker at ILM. When I got the call, when I was a little kid, I used to do book reports or, you know, reports for class telling everybody about special effects. And I remember looking at a book of, it was the making of Star Wars. And there were these guys in front of the Millennium Falcon and just looking at these guys who built this model and who were filming it thinking, I want to be that guy someday. Like, when I got the job at ILM and then started working, it was the dream come true. And it was like, okay, I could do this for until I retire. The industry started shifting over to CG. And I could kind of see the writing on the wall. We have so many shots. And then all of a sudden, they're like, oh, that's going to go to the computer department. Oh, and then, oh, these guys are going to do this element. So it was like our job was dwindling. And I just kind of felt like this is a dying art. And then I got a call from a coworker, Adam Savage, who used to be in the model shop. And he was like, give me a call. I got an opportunity that it changed your life. And he and Jamie Hyneman had already done the first season of Mythbusters. They called me in to go, you know, to audition. And I was like, I don't have to say anything, right? I don't have to be a host. I don't have to talk. And they're like, no, you're just going to be a background character. And I was like, I just build stuff. And they're like, yep, absolutely. And you go, occasionally you might talk about what you're doing, but you don't have to host. I was like, I can do that. Perfect. Because the last thing I wanted to be was on camera. I was always behind the scenes guy. That's why I got into special effects. So now we're filming the show and we're a week into it. And, you know, and it was just kind of nerve wracking because you basically have this cameraman following you around all day as you're working. And it's like, if you mess up, you know, normally if you're at a job and you mess up, you hide it and fix it till the boss sees you. And then you show them, oh, look, how it's perfect. But you hide the fact that you screwed up. With the camera guys there, not only do they, you know, film you screwing up, they encourage you. They like want you to screw up so that there's better television. You know, it's like you're sitting there, whatever you were just working on, collapsing in front of you. And they're just sitting behind the camera, like shaking, giggling, because they're like, yes, this is so humiliating. Awesome. Good job.
Oh, my gosh. So was that a paradigm shift for you?
Yeah, it was my worst nightmare. The whole plan was we had two build teams and Jamie and Adam would jump from team to team. We would set up the experiment. They would come in. We'd film and then they would go back to the other team. But it was slowing the process down. So the producers came to us and they're like, good news. You guys are going to become hosts. My first reaction was like, that's the worst news ever. Like, I don't want to be on camera. I don't want to talk. So it's funny going back and watching the early seasons of Mythbusters. It's just like, who is that person? Like, I'm so like, so nervous.
And how did you work through that?
You know, I remember there was an episode where I get in an argument with Adam and it was over some build and he's yelling at me and I'm yelling back at him. And this is how we have to do it. And he's like, no, we have to do it like this. It's got to get done. But then when they edit it together, they just show me yelling at him. So I'm like, oh my God, I look like the biggest jerk in the world. Like that's not what happened. I called up my dad and I was just ready to quit. I was like, I got to quit. And he's like, why? And I'm like, they're making me look like a jerk on the show. And my dad goes, hey, son, you are a jerk. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? And he's like, you're like a sarcastic jerk sometimes. Embrace it. Like, that's who you are. And so after that, it was just kind of like, okay, I could just relax and be myself on the show.
Wow, that's really interesting.
I started 2003 and we finished, I think it was like 2014 or 15 that we wrapped.
And it's interesting seeing how it changed over the years too. And especially how you and Carrie and Grant had much more prominent roles in the show. And when it started, it was very different than how it ended in terms of just your personalities being more upfront. Just the energy of the show felt very different. What was it like when you decided to leave the show?
I didn't decide to leave the show.
Oh, really?
They said, oh, we're writing these characters out. The beginning of the Mythbusters was very, very low budget. A small camera crew, a very small build crew. You know, we used to, like, for the first 5 seasons, we had to do all the builds. And people always said, oh, sure, as soon as the cameras stop rolling, you walk home, you know, you go home and the builders continue working. And that wasn't the case at all. We would stay till like midnight, because we were the only ones that knew how to do what we were doing. You know, we were just making it up as we went. As the show started getting more popular, then it kind of got a little glossier. Like, the style was changing. It wasn't as rough and independent as it was in the beginning. Towards the end, we did have like a lot of builders and, you know, a much bigger crew. But then it was pretty much the last season, and the show had a good run. And we felt, you know, that it was a good time for us to transition and to move on.
Did you have a favorite memory during the show?
There are so many crazy memories from Mythbusters. We were seeing if you could wakeboard behind a cruise ship. If a cruise ship is going fast enough, could it actually pull you behind it on a wakeboard? And we went down to the Bahamas, and I had been practicing all week with just like transitioning from one boat to another boat. But now it was the big experiment day, and we only had one shot at it, because once this cruise ship left the Bahamas and went back to Florida, it was gone. Like, it was going to be miles out to sea. So they're like, okay, we only have like a couple of miles to get this to work. I remember we had a producer on the back of the boat. He threw out a line. It was like a 300-foot line, and the boat that I was on, I was holding on already on the wakeboard. And so I had to get pulled up next to the rope and grab the line and transition to the cruise ship. And I'm just sitting there and looking at the back of the ship. Everybody on the cruise ship wants to see this. So they're just like, you know, hovering at the back. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, this is, if I don't get this right, this is going to be such an epic fail. And so we did a couple attempts, and the guy driving the boat wasn't getting the speed correct with the cruise ship. So the rope just kept slipping through my hands.
Oh.
And so finally it was just like, this is the last attempt. So I just grabbed the rope, wrapped it around my hand. I got like this crazy rope burn, but I let go, and I'm just sitting there, you know, getting pulled along on a wakeboard behind this giant cruise ship. And it was just like this, such a surreal moment of, like, what are we doing? How is this happening? Like, time froze in that second. It was just like this weird, like, this is the craziest thing I've ever done. That was like one of those magical moments.
Wow. Amazing. And you became close with the two castmates, Carrie Byron and Grant Imahara. What did you all do after Mythbusters ended?
After the show, Carrie and I went and did a couple of shows. We did one show called Thrill Factor for a Travel Channel. And it was just basically us going around riding roller coasters and testing the science for the roller coasters. I mean, it was such a ridiculous show and so much fun. But I remember there was this one roller coaster. We went to Wisconsin Dells. It's all theme parks. So it's like, right, you feel like you've just walked in, you've been shrunken and walked into a miniature golf course. Every hotel and resort has like some weird theme. And we went to this one roller coaster, and it was like one of the only wood roller coasters, like old fashioned wood constructed roller coasters, but it had a corkscrew. We did it, you know, 2 or 3 times, and then they filmed us, and both of us started getting these horrible headaches. And the owner of the park came over, and he was like, oh yeah, I wouldn't ride that one too much. It's like, it's really bad. It rattles your brain. I can only do it once, and like I start getting migraines. And I'm like, and the producers are like, okay, well, we're just going to do it 2 more times. And we're like, no, like, we're getting concussions here.
Oh my gosh, brutal. And then you all did a show together after that.
Then we did, it was kind of like a, it was Netflix wanted a Mythbuster type show. And so the three of us did White Rabbit Project. And that was, you know, that was such a great experience. Just to all three of us be working together again, doing something completely different on our own. And to be at Netflix was amazing too, because that was right before Netflix at the time was just buying content for their platform. But now they were dipping their toe in the unscripted reality show. And so that was, we were kind of one of their first shows that they did.
And I've had other guests on who've done shows for Netflix, and there's a lot of opaqueness in terms of understanding how well your show did, who your audience was. So when they didn't continue into a second season, did they let you know why?
You know, it's interesting. It's good and bad. It's good in the sense that they don't really get involved in the production and the creative. Like at Discovery Channel, we would do a show and then we would have all these executives giving notes and telling us to change this and change that. And there was a lot of times where like, you know, we feel like creatively we need to stay this course, but we'll make some adjustments. With Netflix, they were completely hands off. They're like, I don't know. You guys know how to make a show. And so this was the early days where you didn't really have executives making creative decisions. They just let you go and make the show. But to your point, they don't tell you how it's doing. So you're just kind of like in the dark going, well, I hope we hit an audience. And I, you know, it's, I've heard that from a lot of people where it's just like, they'll give you certain numbers, but they don't give you like all the data.
And can you tell us what happened with Grant after White Rabbit ended?
Grant, unfortunately, we lost him back in 2020, just completely out of the blue. You know, it was such a tragedy. He was 49 years old. I got a call from a good friend of mine, Fawn Davis. He used to work with us at the model shop up at ILM. And he just gave me a call and he was like, hey, just wanted to let you know Grant had an aneurysm. He's in the hospital. They just performed emergency surgery, but they said the brain surgery went well. And he's now, he was in a induced coma, but they're like, they're going to let him recover and then see, you know, bring him out of the coma. And then he never woke up. I still, to this day, it's like, it's hard to believe that he's gone.
I was able to meet Grant in Seattle when you brought
the road show.
Right, exactly. But yeah, it was such a shock because one, someone who's, you know, relatively young, and then two, just out of nowhere, something happening so quickly, it just reminds you of how fragile life can be sometimes.
It's just weird because, you know, you think you're going to, oh, you know, when we're 80, we're going to be telling stories from the show. Remember when we shot the house with the cannon? No.
Well, you've been on shows where you're constantly building and creating projects. What does it look like in terms of how you're keeping it fresh?
Yeah, it's such a tricky notion of what is good anymore. I feel like we are in this era right now where I don't know if Mythbusters would have survived, you know, like as a show, as long as it did. When we started, it was like kind of when the internet was taking off. YouTube didn't exist yet. Smartphones didn't exist yet. So it was like there wasn't a ton of distraction. You know what I mean? You had the regular networks and then you had the cable networks. And like at that time for unscripted reality shows, cable networks were king. You had all these shows that were unscripted and it kind of grew organically. I remember the first couple of years, our audience was very diehard. It was, you know, it wasn't very mainstream. And then as the show progressed, then all of a sudden we got a bigger and bigger audience where nowadays to get that kind of lightning in a bottle. And, you know, it was also the time that the internet was becoming more of a place that was creating ridiculous ideas. So it was a really good time for Mythbusters to come in and be like, well, that's not actually true. We tested it and this is the truth. So it was this really cool back and forth of the internet says, there's a story on the internet that we found out that this could happen. And it's like, well, let's go test it. No, actually, that's not how it really is. This is the truth. Where nowadays, it's gotten like nuts, like with all these deep fakes and TikTok. It's like, it's hard to tell what is real anymore. And it's really hard to, I feel like, keep people's attention. There's so much distraction that it's really hard for a show to like hit an audience.
It sounds like a couple of reasons. One is that our attention spans have been conditioned to be much shorter. Then you've got to break through all the noise. And you see, I mean, studios with redoing movies that they've already done or sequels, I mean, a big reason they do that is because they've already previously broken through the noise with that particular property. And they think, oh, well, it's going to be much easier for the audience to connect to this because we don't have to start from ground zero. So
exactly. It's like you have an IP that everybody knows. When you put a new product out, it's like, I don't know what that is. I'm not going to check it out. I mean, how many Spider-Mans are they going to make?
But people keep coming back.
I know. It's wild.
As you look back on your career, what would you do differently?
I don't think I would do anything differently. I kind of feel like everything happened for a reason. You know, it was like, I feel like God just kind of pushed you in, you know, in a certain direction. And I would just follow it, or I'd hear, like, take this opportunity, try this. So I really feel like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Well, you mentioned that you felt like God was telling you to do this or pointing you in particular directions. What has your spiritual journey looked like?
People always go, oh, you're on Mythbusters. You must be an atheist, you know, because you're like a scientist. But I, you know, I feel like science really has a lot of faith in it because you are, I mean, originally they were searching for truth and God, and that's kind of where science was born from. So for me, it was working with a lot of people who just had no faith or just had no, like, it was like, when you die, that's it. You're done. I believe that, you know, this is just the beginning, and there's the afterlife is going to be so much better.
And was there a moment in your life where that started to become real to you?
Growing up, I was raised Catholic. We used to go to church all the time. But when I was 19, I had a sinus infection and I went in for surgery. And while I was coming out of surgery, I was waking up and I remember the nurse there going, okay, the surgery went well. You're starting to wake up. Just, you know, stay calm. And I was like, I can't breathe. And she's like, that's okay. You're okay. Like, you're just having a reaction, you know. And I go, no, I feel like I'm drowning. And I started coughing up fluids. And I remember the doctor just like looking at me like, what is going on? And the anesthesiologist was like scrambling. All the nurses were scrambling. So they got me kind of, you know, they gave me oxygen. They got me, you know, stable. Turns out whatever, they gave me some kind of beta blocker that kind of lowers your heart rate, because when you're coming out, you're like, your heart's pumping, you're trying to like wake up. And that actually caused my heart to fail. They went out to my mom and they're like, okay, the surgery went well, but we had one issue. And my mom was like, was it his heart? Because my mom's side of the family has this rare heart condition. It's like a birth defect in the heart. It's a deformed. And so the walls of the heart are a little thicker than a normal heart, so it doesn't pump as efficiently as a normal heart. So he was like, he's 19 years old. Why? He's a healthy young kid. Why would you say heart? And she told him about the family history. So they were like, we're going to send him to this heart specialist. He'll know what to do. And so now I'm freaking out because they're like, you're 19 years old. You have this condition. You can drop dead at any moment. You think, oh, I'm 19. I got my whole life ahead of me. And now they're telling me, at any moment, you can drop dead. And I was like, well, I don't want to get a defibrillator installed. I don't want to get this surgery. I don't want to go through all this. And they're like, well, he's 19. He can literally do whatever he wants. Like, he doesn't have to get this done. He can walk out. So my parents are freaking out. And it was kind of a moment of not believing it, thinking you're invincible. You know, when you're young, you think you can do anything. You're not going to get hurt. So now we go up to this hospital and this heart specialist comes in and he is like so excited because here's this young kid with this heart condition. Usually, you know, it's older people that he's dealing with. So he's like, I got this young, fresh guinea pig. And so then he starts rattling off relatives that have had this on my mom's side of the family who dropped dead. The reality hit me at that moment. And that's when I realized, oh, like this is serious. So when I was at the first hospital in my hometown, they did an echocardiograph. My dad was there and I was there and the nurse was like, okay, you can see right here where the wall of the heart is a little thicker than a normal heart. And you can see how the valve isn't shutting all the way when it pumps. So your blood's not, you know, your heart's not pumping efficiently. And I'm freaking out. My parents are freaking out. We're just like praying. If I wasn't reading the Bible, I was crying because it was like terrifying. I was reading this book, Power and Praise. It was talking about thank God for every situation, no matter how bad it is. Because what that does is you're basically saying, I completely trust every situation, even if it's horrible. And that just allows God to like move because you're putting complete faith in Him. I completely trust you. I thank you for this condition. I thank you. I don't know how long I'm going to live. That night, I couldn't sleep because the next day they were doing all these tests. While I was sleeping, first I had this vision. I had like a dream that God had pulled my heart out and had refabricated it. And then I thought a nurse had come in and had injected me with something because it woke me up out of my sleep. And so I like woke up and it felt like something that had just taken over my whole body. It was like this crazy energy that just energized my whole body. I was completely at peace. And then all of a sudden another rush of this energy just came all over me and then knocked me out. So I went to sleep. Next morning, I wake up and I completely forget about this. My mom goes, I was praying last night. God gave me a vision that He rebuilt your heart. Then it reminded me of what happened during the night. And I go, I was woken up, this crazy thing. And we were all just like freaking out because it was like, are we holding on for this hope? So we're just like, don't know. Let's wait and see. So then we go into the first test, which was an echocardiograph. The doctor's like, huh, that's weird. And we're like, what? What's weird? And he's like, what they told us at the first hospital, it's not matching up with what we're seeing here. And we're like, okay, so let's prep him for the more intense test. They put a catheter into your artery through your leg, and then it goes up into the heart, and then they pump this radioactive dye. So they're like, okay, it's going to feel like hot coffee in your chest. Take a deep breath, and then they pump the dye, and then that pumps the dye into the heart. And the doctors are there, and they're like, huh, okay, that's weird. Let's do one more. And then he's like, take a deep breath. And they pump the dye, and they're looking at the thing, and they're all looking at each other, and he's like, I don't know what to say. I guess this was a false alarm. This is a perfectly normal heart. And I lost it, right? And I'm like, it was God. Jesus did it. Like, I'm just like, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a real miracle. They have tests that showed it one way, and then now my heart is a different way, and it looks completely normal. And so that was, you know, obviously the moment in my life where I was like, there's no doubt. You know, I mean, there's times when I doubt, and you know, you don't hear from God, and you wonder, is there really an afterlife? But this was one of those moments where it's just like, I go back to, you have one test that said this, and then now this shows something completely different.
That's incredible. A lot of people don't have a deep supernatural experience of God like that, but you did. I mean, how did that impact you?
For a long time, I felt like, oh, I have to do like something great. I have to go do something. You know, it's like, God gave me this gift. I have to go do something. He gave me this. I have to go do something great. And I want to do that, but I felt like he was saying, just tell your story, because it wasn't like, oh, He chose me, I'm so special. No, it's like, no, like He wants this for every single person. You just have to accept it.
Yeah, it's incredible to think what you went through there. And did that help you in situations like later down the line when you were just faced with doubts? Did you just remind yourself of what happened in the hospital?
I feel like life gets so crazy and busy and you lose sight of those things. And like doing this talk with you, like coming on and telling this story, it reminds me the reality. So, you know, I think it is good to like look back at times in your life where you just felt like you were at your wit's end, like that it was, you had no hope. And if something did change or something did happen that you were like, oh, okay, this is reality. It's good to go back and reflect on those and remind yourself that the Lord is real.
And now you've been married since 2020. How do you stay relationally healthy?
My wife's amazing. Like, she's so chill, so like no drama. And, you know, we're just like best friends and we just had a baby. My life has completely changed. Before it was like we could travel wherever we wanted, whenever we wanted. But I feel like when the pandemic hit, it really kind of slowed everything down and made us focus on what was important. And I feel like I may have just kept running if that shut down and that slowdown didn't happen. And it was like, oh, wait, like I am getting older. I need to like think about what is important, having a family. So as horrible as the pandemic was, it was great in a lot of ways.
Can you tell us about a moment in your career where you felt discouraged and wondered what would happen next?
You know, when we got let go from Mythbusters, it was exciting, but disappointing, right? It was like, disappointing that we're no longer, you've been doing something for over a decade. You just kind of know what to do. Now all of a sudden it's like, oh, what's next? But then that what's next could be exciting because it's like opportunities are going to be flying in. And when the opportunities didn't fly in, it was like, oh man, like now maybe this was it. Maybe Mythbusters was my career on television. Okay, time to figure out something else. Because when you're on these shows, people are just like, oh, you're so great. And, you know, if you could just cut, if you can just free yourself from this show, you're going to have so many other opportunities. and you got to be careful not to believe that and just like enjoy what you have, appreciate what you have at the moment and do the best at that. Because if you're looking forward to the next opportunity, you're going to miss stuff and there might not be that next opportunity. And so when things didn't start happening, it was something that I had to learn also was nobody's going to work harder for you than you. And, you know, I was like, oh, my producer, he's going to come up with something, or my agent, he'll find me something. But it wasn't until that I was like, no, I need to start figuring out shows for myself. What can I do that nobody else could do? And that was like a real inspiration for me because now I can create the shows that I want to be on.
So it sounds like you realized you have agency and you started to take more control of where your career was going.
I remember I met Seth Rogen one time. You know, I was just so impressed that he was writing and producing and acting on all these movies. And he's like, yeah, if I don't do it, who else is going to do it? Like, I don't think there's a lot of roles that, you know, for me, so I'm creating my own roles. But I mean, now he's like a huge star. But at the time when he was getting started, he was creating movies that and roles for himself, which I was just like, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
At the end of your life, what kind of legacy would you like to leave behind?
I guess at the end of my life, I want my family to be proud of me and to know I tried to do the right thing.
Well, thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Alan. This has been so great to see you, to catch up like this.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that incredible story and just all the stories from your career. Absolutely. And your life. Really appreciate it. If you work in entertainment, check out the complimentary courses and other resources available at navigatinghollywood.org. Please follow us and leave us a review so others can discover this podcast. You can find our other shows, transcripts, links, and more at navigatinghollywood.org. I look forward to being with you next time.